Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of November, 2025, and this is episode 372. Today, we're turning our attention to the home front during the First World Wars and how ideas of patriotism were promoted, resisted and reimagined far from the trenches. Our guest is Dr. Richard Batten, Honorary Fellow in History at the University of Exeter and author of the new book For King and Country, The Role of Patriotism in the Mobilisation in the First World War, published by Pen and Sword this year. This deeply original study focuses on the County of Devon, but speaks to the national and even European themes, exploring how local elites encouraged men to enlist, enforced wartime discipline and sought to define what it was meant to be patriotic. It also reveals how ordinary people, especially women and working class communities, engaged with or challenged these ideals in their own ways. Richard, welcome back to the podcast. Before we start, can you give us a bit of background to remind us who you are as a historian and what's led you to look at this particular subject of patriotism, wartime mobilisation and Devon Exeter and Devon, I should say.
Well, hello, Tom, and thank you for inviting me again. In terms of my background as a historian, my doctoral thesis concerned the role of local elites in Devon during the First World War. I completed that in 2013. Professor Andrew Thorpe invited me to edit a volume for the Devon Cornwall Record Society on related to my doctoral research. I then produced my first book, which was A Lord Lieutenant in Wartime, which was released in 2018. Basically, it was a project that looked at the Fourth Earl Fortescue, who was a Lord Lieutenant of Devon during the First World War. Basically, it looked at his role in wartime mobilisation and contained his memoirs as well as diaries and a selection of private papers from his archive. What led me to this particular subject of patriotism and wartime mobilisation was a letter written by Stephen Reynolds to Henry Morris on the 8th of December 1917, where, as District Inspector of Fisheries for the South West, Stephen Reynolds had had experience of the unending process of the recruitment for the Royal Navy of fishermen, and it provided him with a continuing source of anxiety and criticism. In his letter to Morris, who was a civil servant and fisheries secretary at the Board of Agriculture and Fisheries, Reynolds alluded to the criticism he had endured from figures in Devon civil society, whom he labelled the provincial patriots, whose patriotism, while they're on the safe side of military age, consists in superintending the patriotism of those who aren't exempt from military service. And so this description has intrigued me, because Reynolds was a unique commentator with a distinct journalistic sensibility, since he was a contemporary man of letters. And so this description suggests that eligible men viewed these notable figures as armchair patriots, since they resided on the safe side of military age. Although this book is based on the research from my doctoral thesis, I went back to Reynolds' description of superintending patriotism and revisited it to explore more deeply ideas of armchair patriotism and wartime mobilisation.
So your book focuses on Devon, a rural and coastal county often overlooked in First World War studies. For international listeners, Devon is in the southwest of England, and it's on the peninsula that leads to Cornwall. It's quite near where Glastonbury is, but Richard might query that. So what makes Devon such a compelling case study for exploring patriotism on the home front?
Well, I think a reason why it's proved to be fascinating and compelling because I found that is basically due to the fantastic and varied material that has survived from the county during the war years. Basically, the newspapers are a wonderful resource that do take into account this kind of like reporting of community life during the war, but it also reveals how patriotism was a contested term amongst Devonians at the time. You have public figures who complained in the letters to newspapers that it was unpatriotic for Exeter City Football Club to continue to play football games whilst men were actually going off to fight in the fields of Flanders and France. At the same time, you had Devon's farmers claiming that they demonstrated their patriotism through producing more for the nation. You've got local councillors who are attacking farmers for being unpatriotic. For instance, one farmer doesn't give over a piece of land that he's renting off a local landowner to the local council to help to produce food production. And one councillor basically wants to try and criticise this farmer because the fact is he's being unpatriotic. And so patriotism is a term that is being discussed amongst the Devonian population. And it's interesting how it becomes a contested term and how they understand patriotism on their own terms.
So, Richard, are you a Devonian by any chance?
No, I'm Dorset born and bred, but at the same time, both sides of my family, from my mum as well as my dad's side, are Devonian originally. So in that sense, we do have Devon links, really. So it's the project has helped me to be able to explore more deeply the ideas possible about the rural experience during the First World War. But at the same time, it's also given me a glimpse possibly into what my family on my mum's side, as well as my father's side, experienced years ago, basically.
So just for context, Dorset is a rural county to the east of Devon on the same coastline, known
it
as
is,
the Jurassic
yes.
Post, and it's where the Tank Museum is based.
Exactly,
which,
yes.
Which we love tanks. If you love tanks, go down to Bovington. Right, anyway, sorry, I deviate. So your book uses Stephen Reynolds' description of local elites as provincial patriots, like the fourth Earl Fortescue, who led recruitment efforts and Cecil military tribunals. What kind of patriotism were they promoting and how did they wield their influence during the war? And also, I was just thinking, why do they have this particular view of patriotism?
So for Devon's provincial patriots, I think the kind of patriotism they promoted depended on who their target audience was. If it was for men of fighting age, then the patriotism that they're pushing is that it was the patriotic duty of fighting age men to defend their country in a time of war. They employed recruitment strategies to educate Devon's men folk as to what patriotism was for military age men at recruitment events. They attempted to stimulate this patriotism through the use of examples that they deemed to be patriotic, but by the same token, there's also examples of unpatriotic conduct. So they refer to examples of localities that have basically families where more than one son has gone off to fight, whereas you have examples of localities where there are not many men who've gone off to fight, and so they become reused as unpatriotic examples. Fortescue also in his addresses does refer to ideas of patriotism, and he sought to try and, through informal and formal means, figures like Fortescue tried to be able to present ideas of patriotism. So on the 26th of February 1915, he claimed that there were parts of the county where the patriotism of young men began and ended with the wearing of a tricolour feather. And by evoking this tricolour feather over the white feather, which was the shame symbol that was dispensed to men who hadn't volunteered. So you had this dichotomy between unpatriotic as well as patriotic examples. You have then military service tribunals, you have patriotism evoked in the context of conscription, where basically the behaviour of the men or the people defending them was basically used as a way of trying to be able to gauge, this is unpatriotic behaviour or patriotic behaviour. So military representatives on tribunals such as Lieutenant Stirling are very keen to be able to suggest, well, if you're going to put your own self-interest first or your own priorities first, then you are being unpatriotic. And so he criticises one farming family who basically are upset the fact that they haven't been able to get a greater extension for their son, that he then says there doesn't seem to be a penny worth of patriotism going. you also then have with the kind of patriotism they present it in the context, if it's a women audience after 1916 with the introduction of patriotism, sorry, the introduction of conscription, you do have them using the discourses of patriotism to try and help promote women to go into farming. And so one lady in particular, Miss Mary Sylvia Camaldi Hamlin, presented the women's war work movement in the county as a way to try and restore Devon's patriotic reputation in light of Devon's low recruitment returns. And she said it was up to the county's women to save the fair name of Devonshire. The provincial patriots wielded influence through their involvement in wartime organisations and committees, such as the Devon Parliamentary Recruiting Committee, Devon's Women's War Service Committee, and military service tribunals. And so they tried to, with speeches as well as meetings, to be able to try and influence and control the wartime discourses of patriotism.
And can you actually derive any type of commonalities in their backgrounds? Are they all public school educated? Are they largely upper middle class professionals? Are there any sort of certain characteristics that you could point to?
Yes, I would say that they're all either above the age of military age or below the age of military service, so between the ages of 18 and 46, I believe. And you've also got women who aren't able to serve. So there is a commonality in the sense that they aren't that these figures are ineligible figures. So in the sense that they will not have the chance to be able to prove themselves, to prove their patriotism through military service. So in that sense, they view their involvement in recruitment efforts as a substitute for patriotic service. There are commonalities in the sense that you have got upper middle class and upper class figures who are very keen to be able to promote the idea of basically we need to be able to save the reputation of our county. So recruitment figures, for instance, become associated with a county's patriotism. And so you have figures who were previously in the military or haven't been in the military who take on board these recruitment figures and do interpret them as a reflection of a county's patriotism. So there are commonalities between the different figures who Reynolds would describe as the provincial patriot.
And do they mark, is it a lot of the messaging that they use, sorry, this is slightly off, but it was an interesting point that has occurred to me. Do they frame this in very much in terms of masculinity, duty and stoic endeavour that, you know, this is the duty of a man and it's your duty as a citizen and all that sort of stuff as well? I know all that sort of thing can be very much interlinked.
Absolutely. And so you do have figures who are referring to, like, for instance, with Devon, you've got what are regarded as like patriotic figureheads to represent like Devonian masculinity. So you have like the figure of the Elizabethan privateer Sir Francis Drake, that the legend of Drake's drum is evoked in the sense of like the drum, Drake's drum is beating. You can hear its beat. Surely it will be up to the men of Devon to answer the call. And so it does tend to be referred in the kind of like, yes, you need to be able to prove yourself through volunteering. And so you get army recruiters saying that you can present your patriotism as a man, but you have to do it correctly. You have to be able to do it through military service. At the same time, the women are then saying to them, well, surely shouldn't you stand up for yourself and be a man and be counted? And so there are the recruitment route marches where women are trying to shame eligible men to go off and fight and then having basically calling into question their masculinity and their patriotism, because the fact is if they're not going to step up to the challenge, then they're not proving themselves as men. So you do have the kind of like it, both in the speeches that are being given, but also in the behaviour as well of these figures.
So talking of gender relations, this is a good segue. You discuss the phenomenon of khaki fever, and this is a moral panic about women's interest in men in uniform. What did this episode reveal about the elite's concern around gender behaviour and the meaning of patriotic service?
So I think khaki fever is a revealing episode because it's kind of like an idea of civil society acting upon the concerns that they have. So for instance, Earl Fortescue is concerned about khaki fever. He talks about in his diaries about he's concerned about the spread of venereal disease in Devon. And at the same time, he also in a letter to one of his deputy lieutenants is concerned about basically women pushing their wares upon men who don't want to have anything to do with them. So he, Fortescue recommends that it'd be a good idea to get women and girls to get to these women and remind them of the consequences of acting in this way. So I think it reveals how, even though these elite figures have these concerns, they're trying to be able to act upon them and trying to be able to keep wartime law and order. And at the same time, it shows the educative role that they believe that they've got in wartime. In terms of gender, it goes to show that basically they're trying to be able to establish women shouldn't be acting in a way which they deem to be unpatriotic. And in terms of patriotic service, it goes to show that basically that there are forms of patriotic service where basically these women who would be going and intervening in these situations would be showing that they were doing the right thing. So you've got then the right moral choice. So they're presenting their patriotism correctly by intervening in something which is very inappropriate in wartime.
So interestingly, you talk about working class men and women, and they seem to have had a more or even more complex skeptical relationship with this patriotic rhetoric. What did your research uncover about the alternative motivations for service, such as loyalty, economic need, or personal conviction?
So I got one example where basically you do have men in Devon who do have alternative rationalisations for going to enlist. And so one resident in Torquay, South Devon, seaside town of Torquay, called Norman D. Cliff, he's outraged when he hears that basically Whitby and Scarborough have been attacked by the German Navy. And he fears that Torquay could suffer the same fate. And so he decides, he's compelled by a sense of local loyalty to enlist in January 1915 because he wanted to defend his home in the only way that seemed possible. In terms of economic need, it's interesting you say that, Tom, because in North Devon, civic figures believe that they could get better results if the recruits were paid more. So you've got, like, for instance, the unionist candidate for the Barnstable Division, Charles Sandback Parker. He basically believes that through his survey of his district, that eligible men were not interested in volunteering unless it paid them well. At the same time, there's one example, I think, in the North Devon Journal, where basically one recruiting sergeant was talking to a lady and trying to be able to convince her husband to enlist. And then basically he tells her, oh, your husband will get this certain wage. And there's an immediate sea change with her personality. She, instead of being resistant to the idea of her husband going off to fight, she then asked the recruitment sergeant, do you think the war's going to last long? In the sense that is her husband going to miss out on this opportunity of being able to possibly get a better wage than her husband's getting at the moment? And in a meeting of Barnstable Rural District Council, the surveyor of roads questioned whether there was enough incentives for young unmarried men to join the army. And it led to the surveyor being basically reprimanded by other members of the council, basically ganging up on him, saying that basically there are the inducements of patriotism and there are people who do think in those terms. Personal conviction, I think really you have got some people who want to be able to prove to their families as well as to their locality that they are going to volunteer. And so you've got, for instance, personal conviction when in later 1915 and then into 1916 with the prospect that basically the voluntary system is going to be wrapped up and it's going to be conscription introduced. You do get this last minute rush where basically the personal conviction of basically wanting to go and enlist rather than having to be basically dragged in terms of what they refer to as being conscripted.
And did you find that Devon's sort of non-conformist traditions, I'm just thinking about Leicester, which has got a very strong non-conformist tradition, Baptist, Methodist, and they have relatively low recruitment in the early sort of first 2 years of the war. Is that reflected in certain communities in Devon? Obviously, not all Devon is non-conformist by any stretch, but we know there are sort of, you know, the Liberal Party, the non-conformist church have, you know, a bit like Wales, did have strong strongholds in the rural communities.
Absolutely. And so Fortescue gets into trouble when basically he puts forward a speech where he basically says that the non-conformist ministers could do more to be able to encourage recruitment. And so it then leads to press reporting that basically Fortescue is blaming the nonconformists for why Devon has got low recruitment returns. But in fact, if you look across Devon, it's not necessarily just individual localities where nonconformity is strong. Like, for instance, you've got West Devon as well as North Devon, where nonconformity is quite strong because of the basically you've got the influence coming down from Wales. And so there's also places where you've got Anglicanism as well as high church, places where those kind of that influence is strong, where basically they've got low recruitment returns as well. And so it seems to be very mixed, really, because Fortescue is trying to be able to gauge what areas are in need of improvement and what they can do to be able to try and improve that. And so with that in mind, they do take into account nonconformity in their addresses, in the sense of trying to be able to encourage more nonconformist populations to try and come forward to be able to prove their patriotism.
So let's look at a different angle of service. Now, one of the book's strengths is its attention to all forms of war service, which are often overlooked, especially voluntary and humanitarian work, much of which is carried out by women who are left at home. Why do you think these contributions have been historically sidelined?
I think it's tied to how the conflict is commemorated for communities in Devon, like it is across the United Kingdom. The First World War becomes primarily associated with the war memorials, listing the local men who lost their lives in the conflict. I mean, there isn't a memorial which is a notable exception to this. Dr. Todd Gray highlights in his study of war memorials in Devon that the war memorial for the city of Exeter, designed by John Angel, contains the figure of a voluntary aid detachment nurse alongside the figures of a soldier, sailor, and a prisoner of war. And so you do get the conflict kind of taking place as a kind of like, it is only just the fighting men, it becomes their prime kind of like place. In terms of the involvement of women in voluntary and humanitarian work being sidelined, there are examples where the civic histories of Devon published after the war do record the humanitarian achievements that the respective populations did during the war years. The civic history of the West Devon town of Tavistock has a chapter, for example, dedicated to the women of the town and the surrounding district and what they did in 1914-18, which includes forms of service, including the women who worked in the VAD hospitals and those who collected sphagnum moss, which was used for medical purposes. However, I think that the history of those forms of service by women during the First World War became rather sidelined and overshadowed was by the role that women played during the Second World War and the histories that examined the involvement of these women in the Second World War. For the women who undertook forms of service in the Second World War, there seems to have been, I think, a greater impetus to document what they did. In the Dorset History Centre, there is the Dorset Women's Institute, which created a book that recorded what the various groups of the WI did in Dorset during the Second World War, and it's available to look at in the Dorset History Centre. And so I think that we've got more material that has basically emerged after the post-war period about what women did in the Second World War for counties like Dorset and Devon, as well as Cornwall.
And was there a tension between national calls to serve king and country and more grounded local forms of duty? In other words, how far was patriotism shaped by place and community rather than sort of national propaganda?
Absolutely. There was a tension between national calls to fight and more grounded local forms of duty. One group who epitomised that was the Devon's farmers, because they believed that to drop their tools and take up arms against the Germans in France and Belgium was not the only way in which they could show their patriotism. They instead proposed that it was their patriotic duty to produce food for the nation in a time of crisis. You also see this tension at recruitment meetings when Devon's notable figures dismissed these proposals from farmers, basically saying that the county's farmers could better serve the nation by giving it men rather than meat. And so you have the kind of like the tension between the farmers who are looking at their role in wartime, whereas you've got figures who are ineligible thinking, well, actually the farmers can't be exempt from the calls that every other trade or every other sector have got to face in the sense of trying to be able to provide men for the army or for the navy. I think you've got this feeling of the patriotism shaped by place and community is more of a practical patriotism shaped by place and community rather than propaganda, as their efforts, especially with rural populations on the home front, by what was defined as an appropriate contribution. And I think this is the case with donating eggs to the war effort, because it was seen as this is an appropriate way in which we can respond to the calls to be able to support the troops as well as the wider war effort. And many contemporaries thought that donating eggs to the National Egg Collection for the Wounded was an appropriate way to demonstrate their patriotism. It proved to be a popular activity for many people on the home front, including farmers, because it was a very straightforward and pragmatic way to support the war effort. And so this patriotism was shaped by place and community in the sense of this is the best way in which we can respond to the calls to support the war effort.
And your study draws on a very broad range of local sources, from private diaries to the Fortescue papers. Is there any particular example of an individual moment that really challenged or illuminated the traditional ideas of wartime patriotism?
Yes. So one moment from the book that I think illuminates upon traditional ideas of wartime patriotism was the tense exchange between John Loosemore and Michael John McGahey. So to give a bit of context, John Loosemore is a farmer in his 60s. He holds very strong views as to what men of fighting age should be doing, in the sense that they shouldn't be at home, they should be going off to fight overseas. And any man who stays at home, he believes, is a coward, basically, for staying at home. He challenges one man he notices fishing by a river and asks him whether he should be fishing at this time. And the man replies that no, I'm going to be continuing fishing. And so Loosemore calls him a damned coward. He goes around the whole of the district of South Moulton challenging men of fighting age, whether they're farmers or from other trades. And this leads to a violent confrontation with one local farmer called Robert Passmore Jr. And basically, Loosemore summons Passmore to appear at the Guildhall in the North Devon town of South Moulton on the 18th of April 1916 for assault. Michael John McGahey, who is Passmore's solicitor, cross-examines Loosemore and asks him, why do you want to go around challenging and confronting and interrogating men of fighting age? And Loosemore replies that he felt justified in doing that because he felt it was his duty as an Englishman. And in which McGahey then responds that he feels unconvinced that that was the frame of mind in which Loosemore had approached many respectable farmers in the district. Loosemore argued that the farmers that he confronted were wanting in patriotism. After hearing Loosemore's answer, McGahey said that basically, oh yes, you have got it all, and they have none, because they choose to stay at home, exempted from military service by tribunals even, and work the land to produce food. They are cowards. Is that your state of mind? And Loosemore answered that yes, it was in most cases, including this one. With McGahey, he wanted to try and challenge Loosemore to be able to broaden his traditional understanding of patriotism by suggesting that surely can you not accept the farmers who are exempted from tribunals and producing food for the nation, they are being patriotic in their own way. It's not necessarily restricted to just what Loosemore believes. And yet at the same time, Loosemore is unconvinced that that is a way in which you can show their patriotism. The fact is that since the nation is fighting a war of defence, that Loosemore believes that actually as an arbiter of patriotism, in his word, sorry, in how McGahey is presenting him, that basically he feels that, no, I don't accept that, that patriotism for him is basically military age men need to go off and fight because I can't. And so they have to be able to try and defend the nation because I feel helpless at home. This is the way that that men need to do this, to be able to present their patriotism and fulfill their duty in wartime.
Now, you present your book within the wider field of First World War scholarship. How does your work extend or revise the arguments made by historians like Helen McCartley and Keith Greaves on local mobilisation and public sentiment?
Yes, so I think with Dr. Helen McCartney, as well as Professor Keith Greaves in their work, I think I've tried to be able to show the importance of local communities and the local dimension on the home front during the First World War. McCartney does show how regional history was mobilised to evoke pride in the 55th West Lancashire Division in her work. And in Devon, there was a comparable attempt to mobilise local history in mobilisation efforts to stimulate pride in the Devonshire Regiment with its past triumphs on the battlefield and the pride that the county felt in defeating the Spanish Armada in 1588. In respect to Greaves' work, I think the evidence also extends that basically one example I use in the book where Keith Greaves argues that the removal of recruitment posters in rural localities is not necessarily a sign of anti-war activity. I agree with Greaves in the sense that the removal of these posters is potentially a sign of the otherness of the English countryside. And ultimately, I hope that the book is an answer to Greaves's call for histories of the home front to have a greater understanding of communities where locally defined attitudes proved remarkably resilient in the war.
And that leads us neatly on to the final question. Do you think the topic that you cover is still relevant today? And in what ways does your study of wartime patriotism help us understand how societies mobilise, respond to pressure, and or contest national narratives in time of crisis?
I think the topic of armchair patriotism still matters today because it's a phenomenon that has resonated. We still talk about figures who operate from their armchairs, where in the discourse we still use expressions such as armchair generals and armchair critics, people who regard themselves as knowing better than others. They try to give orders to other people from the comfort of their armchairs and are critical of one's actions despite having no experience of what they're going through. People also today use the expression of keyboard warriors for individuals who are combative online but do the fighting from the safety of their keyboards, for instance. However, as my book shows, it's not a new phenomenon, as ineligible figures offered prescriptions to people, to men who would have to do the fighting. So there was that tension between, well, I'm the one who actually has to go out to France or has to go out to serve on the sea, whereas you're sat at home and you're telling people how to behave and what to do. I think the book also helps us to understand that societies are complex as appeals to local identity do not necessarily translate into mobilisation. People weigh up the options as to what was an appropriate way to present their patriotism, and they can, in instances, change their minds. And it also reveals the clash of generations where, during the stages of voluntary recruitment, the generation of men who were fighting age responded to the pressure from those unable to serve and pushed back against it. In Cornwall, there is an example of on a route march where basically the speaker is heckled by a young man saying, "Why can't the pensioners go off and fight?" And so you get this kind of tension between the generations. In terms of contesting the national narrative, I think we saw that during the COVID lockdowns because people did contest the message that you needed to stay at home to stop the spread of COVID-19. One lady said to me before the first lockdown that the state couldn't interfere with her life and stopping her from coming to the coast if she pleased. But in times of crisis, the state does intervene to be able to try and make sure that, like for instance, in the case of COVID, to try and stop the spread of the virus. So I think my book ultimately shows how people did prioritise their local communities and were concerned about being able to preserve the social fabric of their communities from basically the pressures of the outside in terms of what's this going to have as an impact upon our communities. So I think that's a key takeaway from the book.
And finally, Richard, I should have asked you, where can people get the book from?
Sure. So you can get hold of For King and Country, either available directly through Pen and Sword or from your local bookshop, or it's available online as well as in your local bookshop as well.
And ideal for office and home use and Christmas, I think, will be coming up when this goes out.
Excellent.
So, on that bombshell, Richard, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.